Welcome to the FUMS Now podcast show, where you'll gain information, inspiration, and motivation for living your best life with multiple sclerosis. Find us online at FUMSnow.com. I'm your host, Kathy Reagan Young. Artist and multiple sclerosis advocate Lydia Emily Archibald was born in Chicago. She had a globe-trotting childhood infused with her family's values of activism. This foundation informed her worldview, and her art trumpets her call to the world for social justice and equality. A prolific and dynamic international artist, Lydia Emily's work has been featured at gallery shows in Milan, Berlin, Los Angeles, New York, Miami, Washington, D.C., and San Francisco. Her portrait of Julian Assange was featured in the documentary We Sell Secrets, The Story of WikiLeaks. Gucci commissioned a mural honoring sex trafficking victim Jessica on a wall in LA's Skid Row. Lydia Emily battled cancer in 2010, only to be diagnosed with multiple sclerosis in 2012. She later became a spokesperson for the MS Society, sharing the story of her diagnosis and struggle with MS and her message of hope for others suffering from the disease. Lydia Emily also shares this message in her art, creating four bright, inspiring murals in Los Angeles, Houston, Portland, and Louisville. She plans to continue painting the hopeful murals for MS chapters around the globe. Lydia Emily is the subject of the recent documentary, The Art of Rebellion, a feature-length film directed by Libby Spears. Wow, quite the bio. Welcome, Lydia Emily.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being had. You're so busy. I'm glad that you were able to fit me in here. You are such an amazing person. You're living a large, amazing life. Let's start at the beginning, if you don't mind. Can you please tell us about you, like the you were before MS?
The me I was before MS, I was a painter. I was a painter and a mom. I was a single mom, two little kids. One has autism and requires 24-hour care. So I would take care of them during the daytime and school and all that stuff. And then I would paint at night when they were sleeping. I would paint like underneath the oven light. The stovetops in apartments always have this really great light, direct light that comes down so you can see what you're cooking or whatever. And I used to put canvases underneath that and paint so that I wouldn't have to turn the lights on in the house to wake up the kids.
Oh.
And I did that for a long time until my art career became such that I would be able to paint during the daytime too. And, you know, there was a lot of years of struggling doing that. Now I'm able to work with better lights. That's what I'll say. I have slightly better lights now.
Good. Good, good, good. So you were diagnosed with cancer in 2010 and MS in 2012. Holy shit. I can't even imagine how devastating it must have been for you to have like beaten cancer and then get an MS diagnosis. I mean, how did you handle that? And how did your family respond to that?
It was a bummer for sure. But I don't think that we knew how hard it was going to be. Because when I was diagnosed, I was not doing well. I have trigeminal neuralgia. I don't know if you can tell. I keep flipping my hair. And trigeminal neuralgia is amazing with MS because you can really tap your face and it doesn't hurt at all. But a single hair touching you feels like scalpels. So I'm constantly like moving my hair.
Crazy.
My mom was there in the hospital when I was diagnosed, and she was definitely more upset than I had seen her in a while. And I was like, well, I guess I have to find out what this is. And I didn't have any idea. And the cancer seemed so much more immediate. With cancer, you're like, we have to get it and fix it. There's a sense of urgency.
Right. Yeah.
But with MS, it was more like, okay, this is life. So there's no like rushing to fix anything, you know?
And yeah.
Even though it was just 10 years ago, which is like nothing, there was not a lot. There was half the treatment there is now,
right?
You know?
Yeah.
And half the accessibility. It's not like Google was running wild then. It was close. It was getting close to what it is now, but it was still infancy stages. So all I knew was that I was in pain. That's all I knew. At that time, all I had was pain. I didn't have any of this other stuff, this trigeminal and the feet and the legs and the hand and the brain. I just had pain, like insane pain. And so that was really difficult. And I'm not a big, not like, don't have wildly extensive knowledge of drugs. I know I'm covered in tattoos and all that, but I'm really, I'm literally a sheep in wolf's clothing. Like I'm the opposite, you know, but it was rough, but I'm grateful to have the support that I have. I mean, the thing is, I worked on my community for decades, curating it. When somebody came into my little group and they didn't fit, you just, and then you bring in people who do, and you work it like a puzzle. And I curated my community for so long that when things like this happen, you have a lot of love and support. And if you don't, then you take that puzzle piece out and you, you know, you
remove it. Yeah. That's great advice. How old were you when you were diagnosed?
I was 40. Okay. I remember.
Happy birthday. Happy 40.
I was like, wow, they were not kidding. 40 is over the hill. Whoa, this is hard. Like, then I turned 40,
painful.
Everything was so hard. But then I turned at MS. So I was like, so being 40 isn't so bad. It's just that I have MS. So
yeah, you're 40. Yeah. Your 40 sucked, but not everybody's does.
Yeah, some people's. If you see Demi Moore, her 40's awesome. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like,
yes.
Good gravy.
I know. I'm so amazed by anyone that can do art, because a stick man is hard for me, no joke. And my mom actually had some really artistic ability that she did not do much with, but later in life she did paint a few pictures that I just cherish. And I look at them and I think, how could that should be in my DNA. Why is that? But it didn't eke into my abilities at all. But
my parents aren't creatives. Not at all. And I have a biological sister, and the biological sister and I are both full-time painters. That's what we do for
a living.
And both of my parents were, my dad's a chemist, scientist, chemist guy. And like, they're both the biological makeup doesn't matter.
Yeah. Doesn't, right.
Either you get it and you're obsessed with it or you're not. And be grateful that you're not, because it's not a glamorous life all the time. Like it takes years and years of begging people to just look and hope that they see that you have some kind of vision. Mm-hmm. And I can't tell you how many amazing artists there are out there that will never be looked at twice. It's
you know, that's true.
I'd say be a doctor, be a lawyer, work at McDonald's, do whatever you want to do where you're guaranteed like some kind of paycheck. You know what I mean?
Yes. Guaranteed pay is a good thing. I read that you've only ever taken one art class in your life. Is that true?
Yeah. And I failed.
What?
Yeah. Mr. Art, he was my teacher in the 10th grade or the 11th grade. And he was like, you have no structure and you're not very obedient and you don't follow the rules of blah, blah, blah. And he failed me. And I was like, I'm not going to do that. I'm just not going to do that anymore. So I wish I had more confidence in myself, or maybe more drive to go to like art school. It all would have happened a lot faster. You know, I took the long way around when the kids were young. Like I said, I used to paint. I would literally take magazines and paint on top of them. I understood the structure of a face until I understood how lighting works. I just taught myself.
Oh my God.
I mean, when the kids were little anyways, there's no way I would have been able to go to art school because I was raising them by myself. So it was kind of the only choice I had. Yeah. And I'm glad now, because now I have my own style. And had I gone to school, maybe that would be different.
True. Good point. How did you discover your talent for art and murals? I mean, for art first, but murals really blow my mind. And I don't understand how you go from here to there.
They don't look anything like my art in studio. My art in studio, where I am right now, my art in studio is very realistic. I mean, just oil paint is a whole different bag. And mural painting is, it's like you paint with acrylic paint. So it's like painting with crayons, and it's all bright colors and nothing blends really. And I don't use a lot of spray paint. So it's like doing, in old churches, the mosaic, the windows, it's my MS.
Stained glass windows?
Stained glass.
Hey, yeah, between the two of us, maybe we can come up with some actual words today.
So, it's like that. You paint an outline, just a black outline of whatever you're doing. And so I'll have the drawing in front of me and I paint the big black outline. And then I can hire my crew. I have a crew that I take with me to different places. I used to do it by myself, but now I have a crew that I pay to go with me. And they're awesome. I've been working with them for years. And we color it in like a stained glass. We're like that. We all have a picture of it colored in. We're like, this is red. It's like paint by numbers. That's really the only way to work on such a large scale. When you're doing five or six stories, you're not going to, nobody is freehanding five or six stories. So it takes a lot of trial and error. Let me tell you, there's terrible murals in my past. It took a long time. And now I don't even know that I could do them by myself anymore. Not in my condition. There's just no way. There are times when I can't paint. It's too hot. It's too cold. I'm too tired. I'm in too much pain. My hands are shaking, whatever.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I need that. I need that crew support to help me.
I'm glad you have that crew support. So how did you first discover your talent though? Like, I'm just imagining you as a kid, like doodling and somebody going, hey, that's really good. How did it happen?
You grew up with a lot of love and support. Good for you. I can see it all over you. Your family's awesome. I just kept going.
Yeah. You just had passion and kept going.
Yeah. I don't think until really in my 30s did anybody say that's good.
Wow.
Yeah, I was probably in my 30s. Somebody said, wow, that's good. Or you have some talent. Or that's a good idea. I went through a lot of, the art world, people tend to like women who are naked and flowers. And, you know, there's all these art pieces of art. It's always naked girls and flowers. I call that tits and flowers. That's what I call it. And
accurate description.
Yeah, it's accurate. And I never did it. I just never did. Yeah. And it represents is something that a lot of people consider to be beautiful and pleasing over your couch or wherever, you know, this beautiful, pleasing photo. And I never did that. I did hard stuff, people who were what it looked like to be sick. If we could visualize being sick, what it would look like. I did a lot of political stuff. And for a long time, I had gallery owners say to me, nobody wants sad Obama over their couch. And I was like, I do. So like, you know, like I was doing all this political stuff. So I just stuck with it. I stuck with it. And eventually people started caring about political art. And eventually people started caring about sick art or whatever it is you want to call what I do. And so I just had to stick it out and keep going, hoping that one day people would want to see it, that the world would catch up.
I was just going to say that. That's exactly what I was going to say.
Yeah.
People needed to catch up. Like you were already there, probably ahead of your time. And then people caught up. I love that.
I was so lucky because most people don't get the art until hundreds of years after they're gone. So the fact that like a very small pool of people that a very small pool of people get what I'm doing now, I'm beyond myself grateful.
I'm grateful to them as well. And I'm grateful that there's a platform that I got to find out about you and see your art. It is just stunningly fantastic. I love every bit of it. And I love now that I know the artist. But something just struck me when you were saying you recognized that I was well loved and, you know, with the comment about what kid and, you know, did a kid say all of that. What strikes me is, I think what you're saying is that wasn't the way you were raised. Nobody told you that your art was good or worthy until in your 30s, but you kept going. Like you had this, whatever that was, whether it was a belief in yourself, although you have said that, you know, you lacked self-confidence in things, there was something though that kept you going. You understood, I guess, to your core that this mattered and that this was good and this could make a difference. I don't know. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what I'm getting from you is you weren't getting supported, but you supported you and you kept fucking going anyway.
Yeah. I mean,
that's amazing.
You have to be your own advocate. I mean, a lot of people tried to convince me to work for vodka and sell vodka bottles, design vodka bottles, or do, there are so many jobs I turned down that would have fed my kids for a couple of years and stuff like, you know what I mean? But
yeah,
I just had this vision of, I didn't ever want to be compromised. I didn't ever want, if who was going to believe in me, that what I'm saying, that, that I believe in my, whatever it is I'm talking about, time, political views or sex trafficking or sick art or what, who's going to believe that if I have this history of design?
Compromise. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I would rather be hungrier and be reliable. I'd rather be reliable over anything. So I was my own advocate and I, oh my God, I used to paint on, I used to paint on refrigerator boxes when I was living in Brooklyn. I was working in a cafe in the late 90s. I was working in a cafe in Brooklyn and I couldn't afford canvas. So I would go to the appliance shop and be like, can I have the old box that they would put them out back? They're like, we don't see it. I'd steal them, these old boxes. And I would paint on them so I could learn how to paint larger instead of just having these small things. Oh, and yeah. So that's just,
Scrappy and inherently knowing if this, then that, if I can, you know, blow that up on this refrigerator box, then the next step is bigger. I love that.
That's exactly right. Exactly right.
The doors to the Patients Getting Paid membership community are now wide open. This is a community of people with chronic illness learning to find and create flexible remote work that accommodates their health. I call us chronicpreneurs. There are trainings, coaching calls, networking opportunities, co-workings, and a ton of resources. Want to take better care of yourself and still generate an income? Join us at patientsgettingpaid.com. Well, MS has, I know, made art difficult. I mean, you just referenced, you know, heat, exhaustion, pain, all of those things.
Ataxia.
So yeah. I've seen, because I have done the deep dive on you, that you kind of have found ways around. I think you started with tying your brushes onto your hands with shoelaces. Is that right?
Yeah, but now I've moved on to, so bra straps are dope because bra straps are stretchy and they've got this like, not glue, but like this soft thing on one side so that it, you know, holds onto your skin.
Yeah.
And so I bought extensions of them.
Finally, a good use for those damn things. I hate them otherwise, just saying, but.
And so that way, part of the MS is not just that, it's not, the brush doesn't have to be heavy. It's just that constant gripping, holding it in
holding
place.
Holding on to something, yeah.
And you'll start to shake there. So this holds it into place, which is great. And then I have so many sweet people online who follow my story and send me cool stuff. So I have like all these things that people 3D print make me. Mm. And you hold that on your finger. And then you slide brushes in there.
Oh, cool.
So, yeah, I have lots of cool social media.
Cool friends. Tools, yes.
Yeah, I don't know all of them in real life, but they send me all sorts of neat things.
I love your social media, too. I mean, I just love to follow you. And
Thank you.
I love everything that you post, and I love getting, you know, peeks into your world, into your art and everything.
Friends on Facebook?
Keep it coming.
Or did we?
I think so. I think it was Facebook. I spend more time on Facebook than Instagram, so probably. I need to be on Instagram more, but whatever.
Nobody needs to do anything. You're fine.
Okay, thank you. Mea culpa. So I'm just struck by your it's obviously art to your core because kind of no matter what you've come up against, you have found paths around or through and you just keep doing it. It's very inspirational and
it's very punk rock.
You're right.
Try and stop me.
Super sid vicious of you. So I love that you were raised with activist parents and that you have incorporated that into your life and your art. You formed the Karma Underground. That's a group that raises money for other charities and has been especially focused on educating girls in rural Tibet. And by the way, I will put links to that and links to everything in the show notes. But you've used your art to bring attention to international political and social issues like sex trafficking and the displacement of people. How do you decide on what issues you want to highlight with your art? Like, do people commission you, bring their ideas, or is it your ideas or a combination of the two? How does it work? Okay.
Yeah. Oh, so the Tibetan thing I wanted to do, and that one charity is actually done now, and we helped build a school in Tibet. So yeah, that was dope. We're really lucky to be involved in that on any level. Then there's a sex trafficking one. That's when Gucci commissioned me for their charity, Chime for Change. There are some people who come to me with charities, but like I said, you always have to be accountable. So you have to research the charity to find out where the money goes. You don't want to be paired with anybody that you can't stand by, you know, when the shit comes down.
Right.
It always does, you know, it's got to ride or die.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, yeah, and then there are ones that I care about. So, and there are ones that, there's some things that I get associated with that I don't go for their cause, but I go for their right. So I did some congressional advising to a libertarian candidate when I was living in Texas. Now, I'm not a libertarian, but I believed in what he was trying to learn and what he was trying to do, and I could advise him on how to. I can't get into too many details, but I was able to advise him on what he was going for. He, mm-hmm. you know, wanted to know things. And I was like, he needed what was in my toolbox. Mm-hmm. And I was like, here's my toolbox. And so there are certain people who I work with where people are like, wow, you worked with a libertarian or you work with this. And I'm like, well, I vetted them and I researched it and I believe in their right to run or do whatever they want. I think that's what was so hard about the last 4 years before this presidency was how polarizing people got. I have friends who are Catholic and who are Jewish and who are Muslims. I have Republican friends. I have liberals. I have, you know, whatever, libertarians. Yeah. And we're all in my own paint group. Mm-hmm. I have those differences. And we all were like, okay, we just have to, it was just like with my disease or anything else. You just got to get around it. So that you can keep living and so that we can support each other. We don't have to all sleep in the same sheets to support each other, you know?
Right. So you recognize the basic humanity. It came down to we're all humans. We have different perspectives, perhaps, but that doesn't mean we have to hate each other.
Exactly. And so that's what I mean about charities. Some of them I pick and some of them have asked me and some of them I accept and people are shocked. And some of them I don't accept and people are shocked. And I'm like, well, you should do a little more research. Mm. Just because we look like we're wearing the same suit doesn't mean that we have the same values, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm very careful about who I work with.
I got that. That's smart. Well, okay. I read several places that your portraits are always painted on the Sunday New York Times sealed to canvas. What the hell does that mean? I read that probably five places and I went, I reread it. And I go, I don't get, what does that mean?
I actually just stopped doing that. I did that for years and years. So what I did was I took the Sunday New York Times and cut it up until it was just text. And then I covered the background of the canvas with it. And then I painted on top of that and then sealed the whole thing so it didn't turn yellow. The reason why I did that was when I was growing up, my parents believed that the New York Times was the Bible. They were like, anything it said. So as I got older, I was like, it's not even that the New York Times isn't always right. It's just that they hired different journalists and maybe the story changes. And it was a commentary on the news in general, not just the New York Times, on any news.
Mm-hmm.
It just wasn't what I, so just like some people grew up and they question the Bible, I grew up and I questioned the news. Yeah. I was just
perfect.
Like, yeah. It could be, this was all before apps and cable stations like that. So yeah. It could be Fox, it could be CNN, it could be NBC, it could be Al Jazeera, it could be anything. But it was just a matter of questioning what was being brought to me. And so the backgrounds were supposed to look just like static, just words. When you cut them off and you put them together, it's... So now I only paint on white printer paper. So I fixed that to the canvas now. So my art style went from being completely littered with words to now being completely vacant of anything. It's just...
Now, why anything on there? Why not just paint to canvas?
Oh, I have... Sorry. I have... what's the name of the syndrome? I can't remember my MS. Leonardo da Vinci had it, which is my cool badge. it happens actually to a lot of us artists. It's something in the brain where when you're looking at something, you see faces in it.
Oh.
So if I'm looking at sand, I'll see thousands of faces. You just see the way the shade works, the way things drop, curve, and it makes faces. People see it. Artists see it in cement, anything that's texture. You can see it in cement. You can see it in the wall, in wood, in stones. I can see 1,000 of them around the room right now. So I can't remember the name of the condition. You have to Google it.
Wow. Oh, I will. That's so interesting to me. I've never heard of this.
Leonardo da Vinci was actually the first person to put a name on it and to be like, anybody else seeing this? And it turns out a ton of us artists have it. And maybe that's, if you want to get into science and chemistry, maybe that's the reason why we're artists, because we're like, we're seeing stuff all the time.
Yeah.
You know? Right. And you don't see like colors. You just see the depth of shading, you know. You don't, I'm not like hallucinating, but so working on a canvas, blank canvas for me is really difficult because it's just a series of divots. I don't know if you've ever seen a canvas.
Yes, I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah. Yeah. That's too much.
It makes me crazy. It makes me crazy. So I did the mirror after a while. Now I'm doing white paper. Murals are so hard for me because of the, if it's brick, especially. So we spray the whole thing flat first. We'll get these large sprayers, spray the whole thing white. And that's why the outlines are really good for me, because I'm like, black outline really helps.
Right.
That's why.
How is your MS doing now? How are you doing? And are you on any disease modifying therapies, or have you ever?
I'm on Rituxanab, whatever the generic name is, or the non-generic name. I just did my first two chemo infusions recently, and that is the only disease modifying drug I'm on. The only designer MS medicine. The rest of it is, I know, so I would call it like get means designer MS medicine. But I'm also on a sea of other things, you know, for pain, tremors, muscle spasms, migraines, so on and so forth. You know, I take gabapentin in large doses. I take methocarbinol, baclofen, and then I start having seizures from the MS.
Jeez.
Just about a year ago, 2 years ago. So I am now taking anti-seizure medicine twice a day, and I take all the things.
Yeah, all the stuff. All the stuff.
But right now, MS is, I can't feel the bottom of both my feet, which is so interesting. It's just the bottom of both my feet. And I thought MS was like all in different places, but I can't feel the bottom of both my feet. It kind of feels like you're walking on pebbles, because it's like your feet are asleep. Do you know that?
I did. I went to the doctor for the first time 5 years before I was diagnosed, because the bottoms of my feet both were numb. And I thought it was because I just bought new shoes.
Did you have that feeling like you're walking on pebbles or sand? Like they're like, it feels like you're walking on a foot that's asleep.
Yes. Like yes. Yes. Both feet. It was the weirdest thing. I mean, I even found myself going like this because I just, yeah, I wasn't sure if I was, yeah, it was weird, 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 weird.
Did that go away eventually?
It did. It did. Yeah.
You give up. So the bottom of both my feet are numb, and then the left side of my body from the ribs down, just the left side is numb. And people are always surprised. They always say, how can you walk when, and I'm like, well, you can talk after you've been to the dentist and your whole mouth is numb.
Yeah.
Like, you know what right. I mean? Like yeah. brain is telling your.
Yeah. There's some muscle memory there.
yeah. And I just have headaches all day long and pain. And, you know, I'm blind in my left eye from the MS. So painting is hard because I paint around that. Sometimes depth of perception makes things difficult, but I can do it. And I'm sure there's a sea of other things. I have a wheelchair. I have a couple wheelchairs, but I walk by every day and I spit on them. I'm like,
F you, wheelchair. Right. Yeah. Not today, wheelchair. Not today. That's a lot. And I am so sorry that you deal with all of that all the time. Oh, I hate that for you. When you were diagnosed, did they tell, is it primary progressive or did they tell you?
It's primary progressive now, I think. Is it?
Okay. Or is it secondary progressive? Were you first diagnosed with RRMS?
And yeah, I was first diagnosed with relapsing and then they pretty quickly were like, nothing's working because they tried like Copaxone and Aubagio and all these things. And then they switched me. Yeah. They were like, oh, this doesn't look good.
Oh, shit.
And I was like, speak for yourself. I look great.
You've been very vocal about the U.S. healthcare system and how difficult it is to deal with.
Yes. I even did that thing where I married a stranger.
Okay. I don't know about that. You're going to need to tell me, but hold on. I'm very, very vocal about this as well as anybody who listens to me knows. I go on fucking rants about this quite often, but especially... You know, when you're dealing with a debilitating disease like MS, and then you're the one who has to, you know, I'm preaching to the choir, I know that, but you've gone so far as to saying it's like being cleansed. And it reminded me, we're so similar because I had posted that about 3 years ago because it just struck me that there's ethnic cleansing. And then I felt like this was chronic cleansing. And I went back when I saw that you had said that, I went back and found what I had posted. And I just recently reposted it because of you.
Oh, I have to find it. Will you send it to me?
I will. It's so interesting to me though. Like I feel like we're the, you know, the targeted population in that way. Is that what you meant too?
Well, the thing about it that's interesting is in other countries, they don't have to hide it. They're like, we don't have healthcare and poor people die because poor people obviously are going to be sicker because they don't have access to food and clean water and all that stuff, but they're not trying to hide it. We try to hide it. We're like, no, pay like $600 a month for our health care. We're still going to let you die. You know, still going to let you die.
Yeah.
You're still going to suffer until the day you die. I mean, I have a friend who had to work through hospice to pay for hospice.
God bless her.
She was sitting in hospice with her computer working to make sure she could still get her drugs to not be in so much pain when the cancer was taking over. No, the United States is, and I don't want anybody to think that I am not grateful to live here. Absolutely grateful to live here. And part of living here and being grateful for it is that I can call it out when it's bullshit.
Speak to it, yeah.
That's
speak
part of it. What yeah. it is. And if I'm not taking advantage of that, I'm not really taking advantage of all that this country has to offer.
That's right. Right. And I think it's the height of patriotism to call out the bullshit. You Absolutely. Know, because we want it to, it angers me to no end when I'll post something and someone will come back and say, well, then move somewhere else. And I go, I don't want to move someplace else. I want to make it better here. I mean,
yeah. Why do I need to move someplace else?
That doesn't make any sense. You want it to be better?
I think that everybody's it's like shooting fish in a barrel. It's such an easy comeback.
Yeah.
Well, then move and you just ignore that person. I wouldn't even engage. Yeah. Don't even. It's like, do you engage with toddlers on this subject? No.
Right.
So yeah, no, it's rubbish. It is exactly like cleansing. It's exactly, it's not like cleansing, it's cleansing. So I did a study, my own little personal study recently. Well, not recently. It was like 6 years ago now. I said, I'm going to prove how hard it is to get healthcare and good health insurance in this country. So I went online and I said, here's my story. You know, I posted all this stuff of trying to get healthcare in. I think I was in a particularly tough state to get healthcare then too. I think it was in Texas. I'm in Los Angeles now. I've lived all over the country. And so I was showing single parent, sick, trying to get healthcare and how difficult it was. And I said, here was all my fails. So here's what I'm asking. Marry me. if you have good health insurance and you just want to do charity, but you're too busy working to like go work in a soup kitchen, marry me for 2 years. There'll be no booty.
Just to be clear.
Yeah. You can have all the free artwork you want. And I want to show the difference between the healthcare that I was getting and the healthcare that would be available to me if I was in a certain digit. And I did it. And I married this guy. I got offers from all over. I got offers from out of the country. We were like, the kids and I put all the offers down on the ground and we were like, should we move to Scotland? Right. Somebody asking us to marry them.
Where looks good.
Let's go. And but we ended up picking a guy in California. That's how we ended up back here in California. We just like, so we stayed. And I married him for 2 years. He was as polite as could be. We had the best health care.
Oh my God. How wonderful and horrible all at the same time.
Right. Well, so then here's the catch is that not only did I get the best health care, but my kids did too. And then I started keeping track of what the co-pays were, even at the highest tier with the best health insurance there is, and then still what they'd cover and wouldn't cover, and how much of that they'd cover. So what the best health care costs you and what it costs you out of pocket. And it was just, and then at the end of the 2 years, I said, it's time for divorce. And he was like, oh, my girlfriend and I will be sad to see you go. And then we got a divorce, no fault divorce, no problems. It just parted ways. I've never even seen him again.
Oh, I love the story.
Yeah, it was so interesting.
Wow. My mind is just racing right now. I mean, where have you shared that? All over the place?
It's in the movie, yeah.
Okay.
It was many years ago, but it's a little bit of it is in the movie. I think I was right in the middle of it when the movie ended. Can't remember. Anyways, a little bit of the movie.
I just feel like the powers that be in DC need to find you and showcase that story. That's phenomenal. I mean, like I said, it's wonderful and horrible all at the same time. And speaking of which, sorry, what a transition. You have spoken very honestly and clearly about having a suicide plan if things get bad. Well, I say bad, if they get worse. Do you mind sharing what your criteria is for that and how your family and friends responded to that?
Okay. So here's the thing about MS, which is something I'm talking about in this book. I wrote a book during COVID.
In your downtime. Gotcha. Shit. I feel like such a slug talking to you, but okay. Go ahead. Keep on. What else have you done?
You have your own podcast.
Shit, that'll be next. You'll be doing that next. I'm confident.
No podcast. Here's the thing about multiple sclerosis that I wrote about in this book I just wrote, which we were just talking about, that there's a mortality rate. And that's the thing is that nobody ever talks about it. Nobody ever talks about the amount of people who pass from multiple sclerosis. And it's one of those big things. People are like, well, it's not like people die from it. So that's not true. People die from multiple sclerosis. And not only do people die from multiple sclerosis, albeit a smaller number, hopefully, knock wood. I have taken many trips to see people on life support with multiple sclerosis who've been on life support since they were in their 30s. And so those people are not, I visited one lady who was on life support and was on life support, was getting cancer treatment on life support. She was on life support for multiple sclerosis and they were treating her for a cancer, which is totally the family's prerogative. And I've got nothing to say about their decisions. What I do have to say is she will not be counted as somebody who died from MS. All these people who are on life support will die of something else. And they will say they died of cancer and MS or cancer, because that was what will be on the death report, right? In the certificate. So it is important to me. I'm not trying to scare people. I'm not like, ooh, everybody's gonna die. I'm not doing any of that. But those people need to be counted for science, if anything. Like, we could even just take the names off of it and look at the numbers, and maybe that will bring more aid into the fold for research and so on and so forth. So when I started doing that, when I started going around and seeing these people, meeting their loved ones, and looking at the numbers, I was like, well, this is rubbish. And A, I want to address it. I didn't know how, but I addressed it a little bit in the book. And B, I want to be ready. I'm not going on life support, and I'm not, my kids are not going to spend their lives cleaning up after me and changing my stuff. And, you know, like, so we made a plan for how bad we're allowed to let it get. The problem with the hospitals, there's a lot of problems with a lot of things. I didn't mean to say it like that. The problem with the hospital. But the problem with this situation is a lot of times, and you find this with people who have cancer, stroke, or whatever, you go into the hospital because you're having a heart attack. And then you've had the heart attack or the stroke or whatever, and they're like, you know what else? Their kidneys also could use a little tweak. And then you're giving them medicine for their kidney, and then you're giving them medicine for their blood pressure. And then all of a sudden, you're on life support, and somebody has to make this decision to pull blood. It's terrible. And it's the hospital's job to offer you these treatments. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying the hospital is the devil. Nobody's the devil in this scenario. It is a system that is unprepared. So like my mom, who has cancer, it's on her second cancer. She first had pancreatic cancer, lived.
Wow.
I know, 20 years ago. And now she has non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And so she has a directive, just directive. I don't want to be resuscitated if this, this, and this. Mm-hmm. And it's a directive that people follow. And I think that nobody wants to make a living will or directive when they're 20 and when they're 30 and they've just been diagnosed with MS. I get it. But at some point, you have to. And as long as people keep running around going, nobody dies from MS, nobody's going to. Mm-hmm. And we're going to end up with more and more people possibly ending up on life support and being marked as dying of stroke cancer in their old age. So that's what we did. We put together a platform of what feels comfortable. I won't be there, so I'll be, you know.
Elvis has left the building.
Yeah. Well, I mean, another problem is you have to take into account of people who have religious obligations. That's how they live their life. They live their life with religion. And a lot of times that religion will help steer which direction they would go, what they would do. Mm-hmm. I have the luxury, I guess, of not. I'm all science. So I didn't have that to contend with. What I do have to contend with is my kids. I don't want my kids to be stuck making those decisions and fighting, and don't want to leave this burden to other people, which I didn't.
I love that. And this is, for whatever reason, I have been on this mission. I've talked a lot about this on this podcast. I post about it often. I try not to do it too often because I feel like I might scare people, but it always amazes me. I have said this many times. I mean, all of us have the same shitty prognosis. We are all dying from the moment we're born, right? So I feel like it's super actually irresponsible not to make plans. You know this is coming. Super irresponsible not to make plans because you're kind of giving a fuck you to those people in your life because you're just
going to... Everybody around you. Yeah.
Yeah, because you're going to leave... I too have been on the bedside of a lot, unfortunately, of folks on, you know, life support or having to wait it out because that's what we do here. Like I would give if my dog was in that pain, I could give my dog a shot. My brother, however, just 2 months ago, I sat on his bedside for, you know, the 2 weeks while he got weaker and weaker and had more and more pain because that's what we do. That's such bullshit. Thank you. But I'm on a mission to, it sounds like you as well, be responsible to my kids, number one, and anybody else that, you know, will be left to zhuzh it at the end and make good decisions and make them now. And I'm struck by, first of all, as I said, we all have the same shitty prognosis. We know what's happening. Do it. But how much worse? Like do it when you're feeling good. Do it before you have any, because can you imagine? I always think of like being married to someone and they get a diagnosis and then you're like, well, let's talk about it now. How awful. Like, hate to bring it up, honey, but you know, now we better. So why not just do it?
Yeah. But people are flawed. I'm flawed.
Yeah.
People are flawed. We're messy. We're frayed.
Yeah.
or all these things. So I'm desperately trying to come at it in a guiding, calm, like, this isn't so scary. We just take one step at a time. You're just making pasta. Just start by boiling the water. Just start with that. Nobody freak out.
Yeah.
That's all we're going to do at this point.
That's so good.
You know,
and that's the right way to attract.
Let people know that we do die from MS.
Yeah.
We do. Not all of us, but we do. And it's a possibility. And I feel like taking that rug out, I hope that some people might be more proactive. They might be like, oh, wait, it's not a big possibility, but it's possible. All right. Yeah. Well, then, maybe I'll start to put things in order.
Well, and, you know, the whole point too is if it's not MS, it's going to be something. So,
right? Something.
It's going to be something. We're relatively certain we're not going to be immortal. So,
I am selfishly hoping that bringing awareness to that will bring more money to it. You know, you get enough of people. The thing is that it's the matchstick theory, right? You got one match with its head on fire and, you know, you just blow it out. You get a whole matchbook and you might set off the alarm.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Love it. I always tell people too that talking about it isn't going to hasten it. That does feel like what some people think. And I think it's completely subconscious. Like, I don't think they would say those words. Like, if I talk about it, it's going to happen sooner. But I do think that might be somewhere down in that psyche.
Maybe.
But anyway, so, okay, enough of that. So there was this documentary done about you and released last month called The Art of Rebellion. Can you talk a little bit about that? And like, how did that come about and how long did it take to complete and where and when can we see it? Because I messaged you and I was like, where do I see it? And you said, oh, hold on.
Yeah. I hope. Well, here, the thing about it is that I'm not allowed to know a lot about where it's going before it goes. And I wasn't allowed to be a part of like editing or producing or knowing anything with film festivals, because I think they said that blurs the line of documentary. Like if the subject matter has any part in producing or doing anything, then it's not a documentary. It's a film. Like I made a film about
it.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah. So really interesting. So
that is interesting.
She filmed me for 11 years.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
Yeah, like I was like, when I went and saw it recently, I'd never seen it. I went and saw it and I was like, oh my God, I used to be on Lyrica. I was so big. And then I was like, look at how great my boobs look. They're huge. It's like huge and filled with water and just like, I was like, I have no wrinkles. I'm just look awesome.
Right. Nice and smooth.
Yeah. And then when I was on other things, it made me like almost anorexic and then in different parts of my life. And I think it's awesome. I'm biased, obviously. It's like a photo album for my kids. So I'm like, wow, they were so different. But it's just my face for like an hour, 20 minutes.
How did she find you? How did that come about?
On the Gucci mural, when I was doing the mural graphic game. Yeah. She's a great director. She did a great job. And there were times where she'd go away for like 2 years. And I was like, I guess the movie's just not happening. But I was doing my murals and I was working. And I was like, oh, I guess that didn't happen. And then she'd come back, film some more.
Wow.
And then she'd go away for another year. And then she'd come back. And she worked on it for so long. And actually, the director suffers from chronic Lyme, which, you know, prevents just like MS.
So yeah,
she's
it does.
Always sick. And I don't know how she did it. I really don't know how she did it.
So it was really two badass women working on this film.
I know, but she doesn't ever ask for any attention. I'm like, you need to get on that. But she, so it just played in, it debuted in Santa Barbara. And then we were in Cleveland. Now it's in New Zealand, the New Zealand Film Festival. And then it will go to streaming. I just don't know what format streaming, I don't know when or how.
Well, I know you will share that on your socials. And I will be watching it and I will share it on my socials. The one kind of quirky, weird question I'd have for that is, and I don't expect you to know the answer to this, but if you wouldn't mind checking with her, I have an independent theater here and I would be all about championing to get it here and blow it up and promote. If that's a possibility, I would.
Did you say something about that? I think you. Were you? My memory, my MS memory, just.
Well, me too, sister. So between the two of us, I don't know, but
you remember. Text me about that or email you about that.
I will.
Because that would be really awesome. And then I could come.
Yes. I would love that. I would love
that. Go kick down some doors.
Let's do it. We could do some punk music or something. It has been my great honor and joy to have met you and spent this time with you. I said to you before we even hit record that I was telling my daughter about you this weekend. And I just said, I wish we lived closer because I just feel like we could be friends. And I feel it even more now. Yeah, right. Yeah. We're friends from a long ways, but hopefully we'll get you to know if I can. Thank you. I really appreciate it. And I love that my community gets to learn about you. And so where do they go if they want to learn more about you and your art?
I guess just LydiaEmily.com.
Okay.
LydiaEmily.com. And you can just Google me, I guess, Lydia Emily. But just know this, I didn't write that Wikipedia page.
Okay. Good to know. I'll put all those links in the show notes as well. So.
Yeah. Thank you. No, it was great to meet you. It's a privilege. Thank you very much.
Appreciate that. And one last thing before you go. We here in the FUMS Nation speak to this stupid disease. Oh, you're ready. I love it. As it deserves. And we tell it FUMS every day. If you would please, Lydia Emily, lead us in our salute to the bastard with middle fingers extended, of course, on three. Ready? 1, 2, 3.
FUMS.
Love it. That was strong, like new rope. Thank you.
Thank you. So nice to meet you.
Quick shout out to Steve Woodward at podcastingeditor.com for the fantastic work on his podcast, including editing, show notes, and ingenious ideas. If you'd like help with your podcast, whether you're just starting out or an old pro, visit podcastingeditor.com and tell Steve I sent you. Thanks, everybody. I really appreciate you listening to the FUMS podcast show. Be sure to subscribe to it so you won't miss an episode. You can do that right on the website at FUMSnow.com. While you're there, sign up for the free email list so you'll be among the first to know of any new findings in MS research, new therapies and products, as well as any blog posts and podcast episodes I release. Want to chat with others in the FUMS community? Join us on Facebook at FUMS Now. Thanks again, and don't forget to talk to the stupid disease as it deserves. Tell it FUMS every day.